This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
All right, everyone, this is Scott.
And this is Rico. Welcome to R&RA.
All right, what are we doing tonight, Rico? We are going to talk about, we're going to do another autopsy episode, and tonight we're going to talk about the, gosh, is it? Would you call it the Gen X anthem or the song that defined the 90s? Of course, we're talking about Smells Like Teen Spirit. Right?
I think we got to maybe, I want to get this out real quick, because when we're doing an autopsy, like, remember, you see our little Twitter thing where it says to know how rock and roll died, you have to know how it lived. And I think this is going to be one of those, because clearly this song did not contribute to the death of rock and roll. Although maybe when the point system is all said and done, maybe it did.
Well, that's why we have a scientific.
That's why it's super scientific.
We're going to apply to this later. We'll get to the bottom of that in a little while. But first,
the news.
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, April 4th, 2015, Marilyn Manson is sucker punched by a fellow patron at a Denny's in Alberta, Canada. The rocker, who stopped by the restaurant for a late night meal after a show promoting his Pale Emperor album, I actually like that album a lot, by the way, denies claims that he insulted the assailant's girlfriend and spurred the incident. Rico, do you have any thoughts on Marilyn Manson getting sucker punched?
He probably deserved it, first of all. I mean, you know, there's all the shit about him and Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah, there's a documentary out.
Yeah.
It's getting some traction.
I have to feel like, you know, he's from Glen Oak, so he's from around here.
Yeah.
I have to feel like, this is just my personal take on this, when you have that, the Marilyn Manson persona, you know, obviously that came from someplace, right? But then I feel like when he probably started drinking his own Kool-Aid, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe just got a little too into it, and he probably did deserve it. I don't know exactly what goes on in his brain, but I have to feel like, I think he's just a victim of his own Kool-Aid, and he just got into his character a little too much, maybe. I don't know.
Is you know what the thing that's always trips me out about all this controversy around Marilyn Manson now? Is like, didn't this dude like basically say, like, he like came upon the world and said, I'm the Antichrist, and now we're all mad at him for being a jerk?
I mean, he basically came right out and said, I'm bad, I'm evil.
Yeah.
I'm here to ruin you.
Right.
And then we're pissed when he actually tries to do it.
Yeah, then we're upset that he's not Hugh Beaumont. I mean, it's like, he said he came out.
How many people, like, out there know who Hugh Beaumont is?
Zero. I don't know. Can I think of a more? What else is in the news, Rico?
Oh, my God. All right. So in April 4th, 2007, an article is published in New Musical Express, quoting Keith Richards as saying, I snorted my father. Richards later claimed it was an April Fool's joke, which I don't believe him. I believe that he really did snort his father, because, I mean, what the fuck didn't he snort?
Drugs.
How is that guy still alive? I'm still marveling at that.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to be getting, is he in his 80s now or close to it?
Well, I think they all are. And by the way, they are going to tour and continue to make music and tour without their beloved drummer.
It's crazy, man. It's you know what's funny though about Keith Richards is, I mean, I think his last solo record, I could be wrong, but Cross-Eyed Heart, I think it was, maybe came out 10 years ago. It's fucking great.
Yeah.
Man. And at that point, good. Dude is like in his late 60s or 70s or whatever. Good. It's like, he's still got it. I mean, I don't know, man. His drug use is legendary.
Well, I think they're all like, let's just look at this real quick. Just a few off the top of my head. So we've got him, Iggy Pop, David Bowie, Stevie Nicks in the 80s, just a handful that I can think of. And there's others that I'm not thinking of, right? These people were legendary drug users. Like Stevie Nicks said, I don't remember the 80s largely. Yeah. David Bowie doesn't remember doing two albums, right? Alice Cooper, right? You've talked about him.
Oh, yeah. He's got the blackout period. He put out three records he doesn't remember doing.
And Keith Richards pretty much summed it all up for all of them.
Yeah.
Where he said, I could afford good drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. So I'm not going to kick over. Because the shit I'm buying is off the street and laced with something.
That's how come they're all living right now. Because drugs were more pure back then, and they weren't cut with all kinds of shit like fentanyl now. Like, fentanyl wasn't even a thing then.
Yeah. And people realize how just drugged out the records that they love, that define their life, really are? People have any idea?
If
you listen to Exile on Main Street, is like largely regarded as one of the Rolling Stones' greatest achievements. Mm-hmm. That is a heroin record.
I know.
Allegedly, reportedly, the song we're about to talk about tonight, a heroin track. I don't know. It wasn't there, but
That
scuttlebutt is out there, that a lot of these records by the bands we love, really fucking high on drugs.
Yeah.
April 6th, Tool disrupt the grunge genre's victory parade with Undertow, their visionary debut album, aided by the distinctive and unsettling music videos for Sober and Prison Sex. The album sells 2 million copies and earns the band an ardent fan base. Is Tool a prog rock band?
Yeah, they kind of have to be, aren't they? So how did Tool, a prog rock band, disrupt 90s grunge in such a way when there are other 90s prog bands that didn't have the impact that they did? What made them different?
Like
Dream Theater and Smith.
Dream Theater had a hit. And who else?
Oh, they had
some
great stuff in the 90s for sure. I love their 90s stuff, but they didn't have
the one that cracked radio.
That's what I'm saying. They didn't have like the commercial impact that Tool has had since they really got onto the scene. So it's a great question. I don't know the answer. Why?
Well, I think they were doing a different, almost like a grunge take on
proggy grunge.
Yeah,
grungy
because the guy's playing detuned guitars, like the draw a lot of stuff in drop D, like the grunge guys.
Yeah.
You know, not really virtuosic, like noodling sessions, like what is often in a
Dream
lot
Theater's
of,
more of an 80s style prog metal. Sober, or maybe Tool would be more of a 90s style grunge prog.
Yeah.
And it just kind of maybe fit in a little bit better.
But, like...
Because it was a little darker, a little weirder.
A lot darker, weirder. But, but both bands, I mean, if you're in a prog band, you got to have, like, an absolute monster on drums. And then Tool has that.
He's crazy.
Yeah, so... that's the common thread.
Danny Carey is a freaking witch, man.
You can't have a prog band without an absolute freak on the drum kit.
Absolutely.
What else is going on?
So on April 7th, 1988, when the piano wire that keeps him safely suspended during his gallows stunt snaps,
yikes.
Alice Cooper nearly hangs himself for real on stage at Wembley Arena in London. He's able to slip his chin over the rope to keep his neck from snapping until a roadie can rescue him.
Yikes.
How about that?
You know, it's a wonder stuff doesn't happen more often where there's, especially he does a super theatrical show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a lot more opportunity for things to go wrong, or like shows with pyro. You know, James Hetfield's been burnt really bad mm-hmm. on a couple of different occasions on stage. You know, it just would make sense that there's more stuff that there is to do, the more stuff there is that could go wrong. Right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I one thing that came to mind right away is, like, all the Kiss shows with all the pyro.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
where they put Gene Simmons
up
on the wire.
Right.
All of the hundreds and thousands of times that he's done that and nothing has ever gone yeah. wrong. That's kind of...
pretty amazing.
It's amazing yeah, as yeah. many times as they've done that.
Yeah, because didn't they have, like... I don't follow wrestling anymore, but wasn't there a wrestling incident where one of the wrestlers died with one of those suspension doodads? Was it Owen Wilson? I could be totally off base, but I think it's happened.
Owen Hart.
Owen Wilson is an actor.
Yeah, with the weird nose.
There's only two Owens in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's Uncle Owen. Uncle Owen too. So,
all right, April 8th, 2016. The Guns N' Roses reunion tour gets underway in Las Vegas. Axl Rose, who fractured his foot at a warm-up show, performs from the throne Dave Grohl used to play Foo Fighters shows when he was hobbled. You know, when this show happened, it came up on the internet on YouTube the very next day, cell phone footage of this show, and I had to watch it because I was really curious because GNR had been something else for years with Buckethead and Bumblefoot and all these other characters that Axl employed.
Are we ever going to learn the identity of Buckethead?
I don't know. You know, for years people said it was Paul Gilbert. I don't think it is. But
interesting. Does he have the vein on his right hand like Buckethead does?
I don't know.
Famous vein?
I don't know. I don't think it's Paul. I think that's been debunked. All it right. was a rumor for a while. But, you know, Guns N' Roses had this really weird lineup, right? They had the guy from The Replacements in there, and they just had, like, all the original lineup that we all know wasn't yeah. intact, and Axl had this weird Chinese Democracy era. And I remember, like, being really curious what they would sound like with Slash and Duff back in the band, and I was also curious what Axl's voice would sound like. And I saw him sitting in there in that throne. It's like, what a bummer. You're doing this big comeback and you got to sit in a chair while you're doing the show. And he was also working for AC/DC at the same time. So he was obligated to fill in for them. And he's sitting in a chair for AC/DC shows, which is even weirder, you know? And so it was just, you know, I thought he sounded good. I thought the band sounded good. But it's just a weird visual at a rock show when your singer, your front man, is sitting in a giant throne.
Yeah, does that make you, I know you're not the biggest Foo Fighter fan on the planet, so does that taint your feelings about Axl Rose that he was sitting in Dave Grohl's throne?
Oh, I don't, I mean, Dave Grohl's just like, he's Mr. Nice Guy, of course he's gonna loan his guitar throne that he's got, his throne made of guitar parts he's got sitting in his garage at home, happy to loan it for Axl for
Is
some
Dave
AC/DC
Grohl too
gigs.
Boy Scouty for you?
No, Dave Grohl's fine. I mean, he's a great songwriter. He's a great musician. He's an amazing drummer. He's been a part of a legendary band and a really commercially successful band. he's fine. I got nothing against Dave Grohl.
All
I'm
right.
just not a big Foo fan.
R.I.P. Taylor Hawkins, by the way. So, quick question about that. Do you think... Now, you know how close him and Taylor Hawkins were, right? They were, like, best friends just about.
Yeah.
What do they do now? Do they replace the drummer and continue to tour? Or do they call it a day? Now, remind you, this has happened twice now to Dave Grohl. So,
You're referencing with Kurt Cobain. And
exactly. This has happened twice to him now. Is he far enough into his career where he says, fuck it, I'm done? Or does he replace the drummer?
Honestly, I have no clue. I don't follow. I don't know where Dave's at, whether he's got more music in him to write or whether it's, you know, I don't know how, you know, vital. I mean, I'm guessing
they're in the HOF. So really they've got no more mountains to climb, right?
Yeah. But I mean, but he just put out like a metal record. So clearly he's got like things creatively in him that he still wants to do. I think he played all the instruments on that record. That's the thing you got to realize is he only needs Taylor Hawkins to tour.
That's right. I mean, you know? On their very first album, he played every one of the instruments.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, And that's not to diminish Taylor Hawkins' contribution to the band at all.
No, but Dave Grohl is always a better drummer anyway.
Yeah, Dave can do this stuff himself.
Right.
But it just depends. Does he still have things to say musically? I think he probably does. Because even before Foo, he did Probot. I mean, he's been a guy who's been fairly prolific musically. And I'm guessing that he still has things in the basement, you know, that he wants to deal with. My guess is that after some time passes and they heal, that they'll find another drummer and continue the Foo Fighters. That's what I suspect will happen. I don't know. What do you think?
I thought about this. I've it's like you said, it depends on where he is, but I did think of a good drummer that they could use that's kind of, I think, would fit in their style of music, and it's similar to Taylor Hawkins. I think Travis Barker would be good with them, don't you feel? I think he's got a similar style.
Yeah.
And I think Travis Barker would fit in nicely if they wanted to do that.
Yeah, he's also brings his own level of celebrity.
Yeah.
And so it's like, do they need to fill that position?
Dude, he's with one of the Kardashians. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, but because Taylor was kind of like a big character.
Rock-star-ish.
A big presence in the band. Had more of that vibe than some of the other members do. Do they feel like they have to fill that spot with someone else who also carries that same heightened level of rock star persona? Mm-hmm. Or is just, you know, Joe Sixpack okay? Gotcha. I don't know. All right, let's take a short break and we'll be right back.
I've been a part of the minimalist shoe community for a little while now. Tried more than one brand with varying results, but the shoes I'm wearing right now are from Xero. That's X-E-R-O. They're based out of Denver, Colorado. Let me tell you, these shoes are incredible. The style I'm wearing right now are the Prio, but they have other styles too, depending on your activity level, whether you're doing some heavy hiking, some road work, or if you just need some sandals for the beach. They're incredibly well put together. The soles come with a 5,000 mile warranty. The uppers come with the Huarache style strap. So if you need to tighten the uppers up a little bit to get them a little snug to your feet, you can do that very easily without compromising the comfort. The toe box is nice and wide to give your toes lots of room to spread out the way they're intended. Xero shoes look great and they feel even better. They're one of the most comfortable shoes I've ever worn, but don't take my word for it, people. Go to the website, here's our affiliate link, zeroshoes.com/go/RNRA affiliate. Do your own research, look at what they have. If you got yourself a pair, you would love them just as much as I do.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm. A sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott. All right, cool. Back. Welcome back. So 1991 was a very large year in music. Huge. I mean, monumentally huge. I mean, the amount of great music that came out in that year is mind-boggling when you think about it.
Yep. Nevermind, Black Album, Blood Sugar, Sex Magik. I mean, it's pretty amazing if you look at the list.
Giant
of
list.
Like,
and a,
yeah, consequential, like monumental rock records that came out that year that were like high watermarks in the careers of like many of those bands.
And you above know. And beyond all of that,
the biggest.
Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah, Nevermind, Nirvana.
Yeah.
Do you remember first hearing this song? Where were you? Do you remember? Did it have that impact on you the first time you heard it, where you knew like, oh wow,
yeah.
This is something different?
Yeah, when I saw it on MTV, I'm like, wow, this is really different.
Yeah.
Really different than
Do you think that's because like at that time
I did remember noticeably reacting to it,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, me too. I'll tell you my story in a minute. Do you think that's because our ears at that point were tuned to a different frequency? We had been dealing with, like, you know,
we had
at that point,
cocaine ears.
Yeah, at that point, like 5 years of hair metal, you know, 5 to 7 years of like hair metal dominating the charts, and
yep.
Like new wave and U2 and REM and like.
And
you
now
know,
we hear this super stripped down, raw ass garage punk shit
yeah.
That
with
just
a big chorus, big
just
hooks,
hit everybody in the face.
Thundering drums. I mean, we've been listening to reverb drenched drums for,
yeah.
for a decade.
I know.
In the '80s,
and
then all
it was
of a sudden,
super stripped down and
yeah.
amazing. And yeah, I remember being noticeably taken aback by it because it was so different, right?
I remember the first time I heard it. I'm gonna skate around a name here. Do me a favor, and if it pops into your head, don't say it because I don't want to have to go back and edit the names out.
Right.
But just be cool with that. But I was dating a girl at the time, a woman at the time, who worked for a local radio station, a local college radio station, and she was super plugged into the music scene. And I was a huge music fan too, but she, being a DJ, was connected. And I remember one time I was over at her apartment and she had letters on her magnet letters on her refrigerator that she would rearrange, you know, about whatever was kind of top of mind that day. And I walked in and I think I went over to the refrigerator for a beer. And what was spelled out on the refrigerator but a word I'd probably never said aloud in my life, but it was Nirvana.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's this? And she's like, oh, I'm going to see that band tonight, you know? And I'm like, who is that? I had no clue.
Yeah.
And she's like, and they were still, Nevermind had not broken at that point.
Right.
She was way ahead of the curve. And I remember her playing me that track. And when I first heard it, I thought, this, my first reaction, and I thought it sounded metal, you know,
mm-hmm.
like that riff. To me sounded like, I'm like, is this like a new metal
yeah,
band?
It's super,
but channeling more Sabbath
right.
than like Metallica,
yeah.
only a little more supercharged and up tempo.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is really fucking heavy. You know, that was my first initial reaction. So I didn't take it as like a, like, oh, they were throwing down a gauntlet to kill heavy metal. I took it as like, oh, this is a new iteration, a new evolution
yeah.
of heavy
like
metal.
Like if you took Sabbath and added punk to it.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Rico. I thought it was like, that's how it hit me at first. And so I was like really exposed to it pretty early on before it really broke.
Yeah, you caught like a, you got it before it even broke, man. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and my take was, oh, this is like the next evolution of metal. I had no idea that it was going to kill metal. You know,
destroyed it.
Yeah, and so it was just, that was my first interpretation of it. And then I didn't see
yeah,
the video.
That's pretty cool.
I didn't see the video until much, much later. Anyway, so we have this really scientific system, this point system. I think we describe it as a point system, an RNRA point system of counting points if one were to make a point about counting points. Do you get my point?
Point taken.
We have 5 categories that we're going to...
This is really like the scientific method was beat to death on this.
I got to lay it out.
Yeah.
we are going to take this song, and we're going to put it through this meat grinder. We're going to score this motherfucker.
We're going to chop it up. We're going to put it under a microscope. We're going to analyze it, rip it apart, and find out what's in there.
Then we're going to skull fuck it.
And it's going to be superb. It's going to be like Serbian film all over again.
I'm sorry. But all of this is determined whether or not this song contributed to the death of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Right? And so we've developed this point system.
Please don't try this at home. We are amateur pathologists.
Thank you. Category 1, gratuitous boomerism. Category 2, excessive misogyny.
Misogyny.
Category 3, that we struggle to define, wanton whiteness.
Don't know what it is.
Category 4, malignant machismo.
Macho.
Category 5, culture vulturism.
Vultures. All right, so you know what's cool about this song? I got some, unlike some of the other ones because that we've done, this song is just chocked full of little factoids.
Give me some factoids,
dude.
Might help me score my categories I don't understand.
We'll give you a factoid because this one's got a lot of them. So we'll do a factoid and then we'll do a category. How's that sound?
Love it.
All right. So Kurt Cobain admitted that he was trying to rip off the Pixies when he wrote this song.
Buy it 1,000%. If you don't know the Pixies, guys, go to Spotify and pull up Doolittle. Listen to the Pixies record Doolittle. And then I'm going to say don't pull up Nevermind, but pull up In Utero and listen to the record In Utero and listen to the Doolittle by the Pixies and listen to them back to back. And you'll be like, oh, the Pixies were doing the Nirvana thing in the 80s.
Yeah.
It's right there. I mean, the DNA is it's right there.
What's our first category? In light of that, what's our first category?
Gratuitous boomerism. I'm scoring this one a 0. These guys are Gen X icons. There's no boomer. This is anti-boomer.
This is the furthest thing from boomerism. I'm going to give it a -1. This couldn't be the furthest thing from boomerism.
There's no boomerism at all in this song. These guys are Gen X icons. Until Kurt Cobain unfortunately committed suicide, he was our generation's John Lennon. He was the embodiment of what Gen X culture meant. Slackerism, right? Anti-corporate, famously on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine with, what would it say, corporations suck or something on his t-shirt.
Super introspective, self-loathing,
self-depreciating, all the hallmarks of Gen X.
Right.
Big fucking 0 on that. Because what is the boomer generation? Jesus. They're the self-indulgent me generation, right? This is self-loathing, self-depreciating, playing
absolutely
down.
Not even close to boomerism on this one. So check this out.
Factoid.
So this girl that he was dating before he met Courtney, spray painted on the wall of wherever they lived once. Used to tell Kurt Cobain he smelled like Teen Spirit. So she spray painted it on the wall. Kurt smells like Teen Spirit. He didn't know that Teen Spirit was girls' deodorant. And he thought that it was some cool teen anthem, so he decided to name the song that.
I love that. That's so fun, man.
Totally misunderstood what Teen Spirit was.
It's like, was this guy just not watching TV and commercials? Because I didn't wear women's deodorant, but I knew the brand just from being an 80s and 90s kid who was raised by a television set. Exactly. So I knew every brand.
Right.
All right.
Maybe, you know, I mean, he was busy learning how to play a guitar, I suppose.
Category two. Excessive misogyny. Rico, what is your score?
Yeah, -1, man. There's none of that in this.
I'm giving it a 0 as well. I'm not sure what the song is about other than that little anecdote that you relayed. I'm not sure what the lyrics are. It's hard to tell what the man is saying. Like Weird Al said, he's got marbles in his mouth. But I'm almost certain, with the lights,
is it with the lights out? It's less dangerous.
I don't know.
It's less dangerous. Here we are now. Entertain us. I feel stupid
and contagious.
Here we are now. Entertain us.
But to your point in a previous RNRA episode, grunge was the anti-misogynistic music. We had had enough of that. We lived through a decade of it in the 80s, and now the grunge was the reaction to that.
So absolutely.
It's got to be a big fat zero or a negative 20, whatever.
Negative 1 million, for sure. Speaking of the line, here we are, entertain us. Kurt Cobain pulled that from himself, actually. Every time they would go to a party, when they show up to the party, he would say, here we are, now entertain us. So he decided to use that and put it into his song lyrics.
You know, my brother and I once went to a party with vegetation in our pants.
What?
It's true story. We didn't walk in and demand anyone entertain us, but we decided that if we put like a large vegetable in our pants.
Oh, like a carrot or a cucumber or
yes.
something?
You know, okay. An idea taken basically from Spinal Tap. But let me tell you what, right. dude. If you walk into a party with a giant schlonger or a fictitious giant schlonger, your ego, like, it grows 100 times. You feel so, like, you feel invincible when you walk. So my brother and I walk into this party. We both were like had tight trousers on with just like a bulge, like a giant bulge. And let me tell you what, man, you just feel invincible. And we didn't make any mention of it, nothing. We just played it cool. And everyone saw it. And you just
feel
like,
damn, right?
It's like you feel like you just like there's guys with like big arms who spend all day in the gym. Yeah. And you feel so much tougher than
you get a plus one on excessive misogyny.
All right. Category 3, wanton whiteness. Rico, how do you score this category can't define?
Monoculturistic, right? Isn't that what we said in a previous
sort of
is there any type of multiculturalism or lack thereof in this song, right? I don't think it's absent of the notion of culturalism, right? So
yeah,
I think you can score it because it's not even in the universe, right?
And it's kind of born, you know, I mean? Out of like, where are they at? Kurt Cobain grows up in a lower middle class family in like Seattle, right? Mm-hmm. And like, so it kind of like a depressed area. So this is not a song that comes from privilege. This is not a band that comes from privilege, right? And it isn't. It's maybe excessively white in the sense that it comes from its DNA musically is coming from places like the Pixies and Black Flag and like bands that kind of have, you know, they're kind of like definitely rooted in, you know, that culture, right? That isn't super diverse, but
I'm not seeing, let me just say this, I guess I'm not seeing any type of multiculturalism in this at all. So I'm probably gonna give it because I'm just thinking out loud. Grunge, like Seattle grunge, right? It wasn't super multiculturalistic, right? I'm seeing it as more like white suburbia, you know, reacting against the 80s. And so I'm probably gonna give them a one for that.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna agree, and just because I don't want to deal with the actually, I'm skewing 0.5, but I'm going to go ahead and give it a 1.
Right.
Yep.
Sounds good.
All right. Malignant machismo.
Is machismo, is there room for interpretation here?
Yeah.
All right.
Fuck yeah, dude. This is highly scientific.
So,
if you can't tell by how we struggled with the last category.
We're still trying to figure out what excessive whiteness really means.
I think it's like the judge who had the rule on the pornography case. It's like, you know it when you see it.
Right.
But it's really fucking hard to define.
Exactly. Exactly. So machismo, I mean, I think, man, that's, you go first. I'm going to stall by making you answer this one first.
I'm going to give this one a 0. And it's not really because of the song. It's because of what I know of Kurt Cobain. I didn't know him personally. Watched some documentaries, Montage of Heck, and you know the other one that they've seen a few things on the TV about him and what I've read about him, is that this was a guy who was bullied. who had, you know, the macho stereotypes in his life were the bad guys. They were jocks. They were an angry stepdad or whatever, an uncle, a neighbor, the people that pushed him around, right? So yep. This guy had no room in his heart for that kind of behavior.
True.
He identified with champion, you know, he would champion, you know, feminist ideals. He was a guy who wore a ball gown onto the Headbangers ball.
I was just going to say that he wasn't averse to wearing Courtney's clothes. He wore female sunglasses. He colored his hair like a color that typically girls would color their hair.
Yep.
He kind of dabbled in androgyny a
little
tad.
Bit. Yep. But the music... Musically, super muscular.
Super muscular.
I mean, powerful. So I'm kind of struggling with this one because I'm thinking of him as the person, but the song, to me, is full of testosterone, full of anger, full of, like, it is kind of a muscular song. So just on the music alone, I'm going to go ahead and give it a... I'm going to give it a one.
I'm going to go... At first, I was going to say zero, but just to how... heavy and in your face the song is, I'm gonna go 0.5 on that.
Do you have a factoid to lead us into the next one?
Boy, I got tons. I just gotta pick a good one.
I think I skipped you on the
no
last
that's
one.
Okay,
you can back to back them.
Well, I'll do a couple of small ones. So here's one. The cheerleaders in the video,
yeah man,
were actually strippers that were hired from a local strip club.
That's rock and roll.
It's very rock and roll.
That's rock and roll, yeah. Man. You know, dude, and for aspiring rock musicians, strippers like would give them shelter and food. And that was how you had a place to crash.
Certainly. All right, here's blah, blah.
Because they made money.
Well, certainly. certainly. All right, let's see. You know, at the end where they destroy the shoot or where they just go crazy and start smashing stuff?
Yeah, man.
It says here the climactic destruction at the video's finale was not choreographed, actually. The fans were angry and fed up at the end of the shoot, which took over 12 hours to shoot this video. They were allowed to go mental and destroy the set. And so that's what they did. They filmed it. They put it in the video.
Wow.
How about that?
Very cool, man. Yeah, it's a, you know, that whole idea of, like, destruction in the high school.
Yeah.
You know, very... We see it in rock and roll high school from the 70s with the Ramones and, you know, that's something that, like, after Columbine, you know, and that came along in, like, what, 98 was Columbine?
Yeah, something like that.
That stuff died, man. You do not see that stuff. Like,
No.
Yeah, it's like a, that was something that, like, it was very common in culture to see kids destroy the high school. It was in a million 80s movies.
I know.
I mean, it just was, you know.
You can't even talk about it anymore.
You can't even talk about
it. You can't make movies
anymore.
About it. You can't make videos.
Because it's actually happened, like, in real life so many times.
Fucking life ruining art, man.
Final category. Culture vulturism.
Well, I'm going to say... I mean, because he so blatantly admitted that he was trying to rip off the Pixies on this, and I also feel like I think they were appropriating punk and the Pixies. I'm going to give him a solid one on this. I kind of am.
I think that, I guess the angle I would take with it, though, is like...
I mean, I'm okay. I'm really, really okay with what they did, but... Scientifically, we have to consider...
You're drawing some...
Consider the
places
sources.
Where they've documented influence that was, you know, and to what level was inspiration and what level was borrowing.
And that's the thing.
And then... But I think I do recall, too, of, like, the riff. Was just, like, that was just more than a feeling by Boston.
And he said... And then he admitted that it sounded like it, but then he said it's just such a what do we call that? Such a, like, a common riff.
Stock
riff, is that's what I'm looking for. Yeah. He did admit that it sounded similar to that.
Yeah, and I never would have picked up on that. And then someone was, I don't know if it was him.
I didn't even think about it until I read that. And then I'm like, wow, it does kind of sound the same.
But here's the thing. Here's the angle I would look at it is if this song represented this change in the music scene, this cataclysmic atom bomb that was dropped into the music world in 1991. And like the meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs, completely wiped out all the music that came before it. All of a sudden, Trickster and Poison and Dangerous Toys and Motley Crue are all looking for work, right? They're all completely wiped out, right? The metal bands are like, holy shit, you know, we now look ridiculous. And then hair metal bands are out of work. And then all of a sudden you would go in the very next day, you go into Macy's and there's a mannequin wearing Doc Martens and a flannel shirt. And like everything changed overnight from this one instance. And like, that's called a disruption, right? And in marketing, there's this idea of like disruption, right? And so in order to be innovative, you have to be disruptive. And so we've seen this happen a few times in the course of music where you had true disruption in music, right? You could cite the punk movement in the 70s where things got overly corporate and stale, and then punk comes along and blows it all up and resets the whole thing. And grunge was kind of like a second punk music, right? A second punk rock disruptor.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this.
So can you be aping something else and be disruptive? Does that make sense?
I think what I'm doing is I'm getting what I'm calling them aping is just musical influence.
Right.
And what you're talking about is.
But that influence is pretty strong if you listen to the Pixies.
Sure, yeah. But I mean.
It's there in a big way.
I heard
way.
Once a saying about creativity where the most creative people are the best at hiding their sources.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I think David Bowie said, I'm just a clever thief. You know?
Right. Yeah. So everybody's influenced by somebody.
Yep.
But. What you're speaking of is they are the anti-vultures, where they did the complete opposite. So I guess from what,
I wasn't trying to, because I think I see from where yours, I think you have a legitimate point. I'm just trying to like frame it in terms
not,
of,
but being influenced by the Pixies and punk rock and Sabbath is not. Culture vulturism, it's just musical influence.
Just having influences, yeah.
I think it's just musical influence.
Yeah. It's always, but that's always a tough line though, because if you look at like, you could say, well, Jimmy Page was influenced by the blues, but Led Zeppelin 1 is littered with songs that are just,
yeah,
they're ripoffs that were uncredited and he later had to pay these people. Yeah, that's culture vulturism in a big way, right? So
sure.
It's like, you know, he later had to credit these guys and pay them. And there's a reason for that, you know, because you were just being too obviously influenced and not that clever thief that David Bowie was talking about. But I guess I'm struggling with this one a bit because
tough.
I do think
me too.
If you think of the 90s and you think of music, that album and that song that we've been talking about for 20 minutes now specifically is recognized as being the bomb that was dropped. And I just, to be a true disruptor to that level, to completely upend the music scene, we've never seen anything like it since, you know?
Not right. Not, no.
And
you're right.
So
that song was the disruptor of what became one series, like a huge series of culture vultures in the 80s, and they were the disruptor of that. So from that perspective, you could never call them culture vultures, but from the musical perspective, you could absolutely call them culture vultures because they even admitted they were.
Yeah.
So yes. Where do you come out on that?
Cheese out and split the difference to give them a 0.5. That's what I'm going to do. And there's another thing too, is that if you check out another big song off of Nevermind was Come As You Are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go and check out a proto-punk band, not a proto, I'd call them a post-punk band from the 80s called Killing Joke, has a song called 1984,
mm-hmm.
which is Come As You Are.
Yeah.
And the riff is identical.
Yeah.
And I think they did actually pursue some litigation towards Nirvana for that. So is other precedent of Kurt Cobain being too closely influenced by some of his
I'm gonna stick to my one. I'm gonna stick to
all
it.
Right. I gotta do some math, so let me take my shoes off.
I've got 2.5, but then I've got a -1 and a -1. So I'm a 0.5. Where are you at?
I have 2.5. I didn't deal. I'm not smart enough to deal with negative numbers. So yeah. I'm at 2.5.
So our composite number is a 3 out of 10.
And as predicted, this song did not contribute to the death of. If anything, you could argue it may have saved rock and roll.
Right.
If you look at where rock music, although as we just pointed out, 91 was a great year for rock music, but maybe just getting rid of a few of the, you know.
So what if we do that? If 80 and above is you contribute to the death of rock and roll. If it's below a certain number, then you contributed to rock and roll.
Ah,
what
I
if
like
we
that.
Do that?
I like that.
So where
what's
do we
that number going to be?
I don't know. I mean, it's our pod, so
we
can
really
make it,
figure this out.
We can make it. Why don't we
stay tuned
this
for
is,
the next episode?
Two and
we
a half.
Will have,
and where are you at? What's your total number?
2.5.
2.5, and I've got what did I say? A half. So 3. Yeah. So why don't we say 3 or below.
Below? Yeah, you got it. I started to mouth it as you were saying it, but then I was hoping we were in sync.
So not only did this song not contribute to the death of rock and roll, but it actually contributed to rock and roll, which is what we thought.
Which is, yeah, we kind of knew that going in, but it's a fun exercise anyhow.
Yeah.
All right, guys, if you can take to Apple, leave a review. Spotify, give us 4 stars. Give us 1 star if you think this is ridiculous. Thanks for listening.
See you later.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
To the dawn, love it to the morning. I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNRAutopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.